Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. We're so glad to have you with us here this evening on Ask Herbal Health Expert Susan Weed, a two-hour radio show each Tuesday night. Herbal medicine is people's medicine, simple, safe, effective. Please bring your curiosity and health questions. Susan will enlighten, surprise, and delight you. I know most of you know Susan Weed already, but for those of you who have not yet met Susan, I'd like to share. She is the author of the Wise Woman Herbal series, including five wonderful books on women's health and herbal medicine, Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year, Breast Cancer, Breast Health! The Wise Woman Way, Healing Wise, The Wise Woman Herbal, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and Susan's latest book, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. In addition to being the editor at Ash Tree Publishing and writing her books, Susan is the director of the Wise Woman Center in Woodstock, New York. The Wise Woman Center is open to the public on appointment-only basis. She offers weekend workshops, intensives, and apprenticeships throughout the season. Susan is also available to you online via wisewomanmentor.com. There you can go and view her weekly e-zine. You can subscribe to receive a notification via email each week, or you could join her mentorship program. Susan also offers distance learning correspondence courses and online courses at the Wise Woman University. But you can also just go to her website, susanweed.com, where you will find thousands of pages online with recipes, articles, art features, and so much more. Well, for now, let's see what Susan has to share with us this evening. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
Good. Do we have some questions tonight? How are you?
Yes, we have questions tonight. I consult with Susan Brown about my osteoporosis and periodontal issues. I follow her vitamin protocol and suggestion to drink nettle and oat straw infusions. I'm highly motivated to boost my bones naturally. Are you still able to hear what I'm saying, Susan?
I hear you very well. Yes, thank you.
Okay. I want to check if I'm infusing correctly with the right herbs. Thanks for answering my questions. I've been infusing 1 ounce to 1 quart a day of nettles, oat straw, and red clover, drinking a different one each day for 6 days a week, like the woman you wrote about who reversed her bone issues. However, I'm not keen on the red clover and thinking of stopping. I also read that red clover isn't good for my blood type 0, according to this doctor. Do you agree that I should stop red clover? Do you recommend I drink nettles and oat straw equally, or more nettles? There are more questions here. Do you want me to stop so I don't have to repeat them again?
That would be excellent, yes. So, there's a very long discussion at WestonAPrice.org. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh,
I was
there's
coughing, and I put my hand over the phone. The next time I'll just cough into the phone, if that's better.
That's fine. I just heard a big click. So at the WestonAPrice.org website, there's a very long discussion of why blood type diets are absurd, and they truly are. But let me put it this way. If you want to, say, do an organ transplant, you have to look at blood type. But did you know that there are over 30 different factors that actually make up blood type, and A, B, and O are only one of those 30 factors, and if you simply match an organ based on A, B, and O blood types, there's a very strong likelihood it will be rejected. So saying that you should or shouldn't eat something because of the blood type is foolish, extremely foolish. And I would not in any way judge my diet on any blood type information. So that said, please don't feel that the infusions have to be nasty. They certainly can be pleasant. Many people find that red clover heated up with some honey in it is just wonderful. I personally don't like the astringency of the red clover, so when I brew my red clover, I put a pinch of mint in it. I mean literally a pinch, the amount of dried mint that I can pinch between my thumb and my forefinger. And that little bit of mint really changes it for me. Some people like to add all kinds of things to their infusion. I've known some people who've heated up their infusion and added instant coffee. Some people mix it with fruit juice. Some people like to have it with whiskey. So if you're thinking that you don't like red clover, I'm thinking that you haven't tried yet to find a way to like red clover. The woman that I wrote about, in fact, only drank four quarts of infusion a day. My goal is to drink a quart every single day. She took Sunday off because, as she basically put it herself, she was kind of a lazy person. So I'm not sure exactly why it is that you're replicating that. It's not as though it's important at all. I rotate through five different herbs. I drink a quart of stinging nettle. The next day, say, a quart of oat straw. Then the next day, say, a quart of red clover. The next day, a quart of comfrey leaf. And the next day, a quart of linden. I think they're all important. If for some reason you decide that you don't want to drink red clover, then what I would suggest is that you drink comfrey instead of the red clover, and that you rotate through the stinging nettle, the oat straw, and the comfrey. The fact that she simply drank red clover, oat straw, and nettle doesn't mean that that was the best choice. It's simply one person's choice. And again, it's alarming to me that you have made this one person's choice into some kind of protocol. It certainly is not. In fact, what I often say when I tell that story is, if I could have gotten her to eat a quart of yogurt a week and exercise, we could have reversed her bone loss far faster. Furthermore, if I could have gotten her to avoid eating any soy except for miso or tamari, we would have improved her bone mass faster. Supplements? I'm absolutely, totally, and completely against supplements. Remember that women who take calcium supplements double the risk of a broken bone. I think that's all the first questions. I want to go on to the
okay.
rest of the
next question. I also read about comfrey leaves and thought to try it in place of red clover. However, I don't want to water down the effects of the nettles and oat straw. Do these herbs interact with one another or work separately? Which and what amounts do you think are best given my issues, which are osteoporosis and periodontal?
So actually, I have pretty much already answered that question. That is my goal. Is a quart of infusion every day, rotating through five herbs, stinging nettle, oat straw, red clover, comfrey leaf, and linden infusion. I think that osteoporosis is primarily caused by an inadequate diet and certainly lack of exercise as well. You haven't mentioned anything at all about exercise, so I hope you are adding that component to your treatment plan.
After adding boiling water, I close the canning jar tight and leave it on my counter overnight. Should I refrigerate it right away instead? Will it lose its potency? After straining, I drink half warm, then refrigerate and drink the rest later. Your book, Menopausal Years, was such a help when I went through menopause. I hope you don't mind me reaching out to you now. Thanks again.
I certainly don't. I must say that when the infusion comes out of the, you're doing everything right, and when the infusion comes out of the jar in the morning, it's kind of lukewarm, and I think it tastes absolutely the worst and the nastiest at that point. So I give you a bow if you can tolerate it at that point, but I sure could not. If I want to drink some right away, I always pour it over ice or heat it up nice and hot. What you're getting from the infusions are nutrients that are extremely stable. you would actually do damage to your refrigerator if you put that boiling hot jar of infusion in the refrigerator, so please leave it on the counter. But heating up the infusion is not going to hurt it. Pouring it over ice is not going to hurt it. You're getting minerals, but your bones need minerals, and minerals are extremely stable. Nourishing herbal infusions are foods. They're not medicines.
Thank you. All right, so now we're going to launch into some of the questions that were posed when you had the teleseminar with, was it the last teleseminar you had, was that with Lisa or Sally?
Alisa
Starkweather.
Yes.
And unfortunately, we were not able to answer any questions because the teleseminar was a short one. So we have questions. We promised we'd answer them. And
okay.
I know it's been a couple of weeks, but here we go. I am a midwife feeling overwhelmed with meetings with doctors, hospital midwives, being reported to the nurses board, dealing with hospitals, and all of that while doing home birth. What advice do you have for me?
I find it very useful. Light a candle each night, even if it's just for a minute or two before I go to sleep. And into that candle I put my cares and concerns that I've had in the day, and I let them burn up and move into the smoke. And then I burn and then I blow the candle out after it's burned, just for a minute or two. It's just a little ritual that I find very useful. I'm also going to share with you one of my very favorite spells. You don't say specifically what's happening, but I suspect that this spell will be of very great use to you. It's in three parts. The first part is about you, and it consists of one sentence. I, and then your name and soul, exist in the universe. So if I was doing this spell, the first part would be, I, Susan S. Weed, exist in the universe. It's just that simple statement. Part two. We make that same statement about anyone that we are in a difficult relationship with. So you say something about being reported to the nurses board. So you could say, and the nurses board of, and be specific, is it a state nurses board, national nurses board, be as specific as possible, exists in the universe. If there's a person who's reported you, include them. Part two can be many statements, but they're all the same statement. The lawyer, and then you name the name of the lawyer, exists in the universe. The person who reported me, and you name their name, exists in the universe. The nursing board of, and you're as specific as possible, exists in the universe. You can list as many things in step two as are involved in the case. Step three. I and all of the people that I have listed in step two are working together for the greatest possible good. And that is the spell. It sounds very simple, but it has very powerful results. Hope this helps you. Green blessings.
Thank you. Do you agree that eating only raw goat's milk products can prevent or even cure asthma, which my son gets if eats regular dairy products, even raw cow? Does the goat make that much difference?
There's a variety of different things kind of rolled into this one question. And let's look back a little bit. The idea that dairy products and breathing difficulties were somehow related comes from a man named Arnold Arendt, who was actually thrown out of medical practice during the time when he was practicing, because he was accused of killing a great many people. He decided that milk caused mucus and therefore breathing problems by drinking nothing but milk for 3 days and then cutting his arm open And that was raw cow's milk because there really wasn't much else available to them. So this idea, which has never been established scientifically, still rolls around in the heroic tradition. I link fear of milk to problems with mother, and of course, many of us do have problems with our mother. It takes a while for us to kind of let our mother just be another human being on the planet and to stop being mad at her for all the supposed things she should or should not have done. So when you say that cow's milk gives your son asthma, I must say I'm extremely dubious. I just don't believe and have never seen any proof of any kind anywhere that drinking any kind of milk could give someone asthma. And certainly scientific studies have shown exactly the opposite. In fact, what science shows is that asthma is usually related to living in an environment that is too clean. This is one of the reasons why raw milk is thought to be so helpful, because it helps recolonize the gut flora. Whenever anyone is dealing with asthma, that is certainly one of the things that I like to do, is to see to it that gut flora is well and healthy. Mullein leaf infusion is a very great aid for people who are dealing with any kind of breathing issues. I usually strain the mullein infusion. We make it just the way we make all of our infusions, with 1 ounce of dried mullein, 1 quart of boiling water, combined, tightly lidded, and left to sit overnight. When I strain that, I strain it through a cloth because the mullein's hairy and you want to be sure you don't have the hairs in your brew. And then I mix it half and half with milk. In this case, if you want it to be raw goat's milk, I'm certainly in favor of raw goat's milk. I keep a herd of dairy goats, and that's why, because I want to supply myself with raw goat's milk. It is, however, illegal in the United States to buy or sell raw milk in most areas, and so certainly I would not want to get either one of us in trouble by suggesting that raw milk is anything other than a health problem. The Food and Drug Administration at this point is actually more worried about raw milk than they are about heroin. They think that it's a greater threat to people's health. So that said, I don't think there is that much difference between cow's milk and goat's milk, but certainly enough difference that I prefer goat's milk. I hope this has been helpful for you, and I hope you make the mullein milk, heat it up, half mullein infusion, half milk with a spoonful of honey. Yum, yum. 2 cups a day of mullein milk for 6 weeks, and I think your son will be breathing a lot easier, no matter what kind of milk he drinks.
Thank you. Why is the liver of animals good when this is an organ that filters the toxins? Any insight is greatly appreciated, as my coworkers and I need help understanding this.
All right. Well, you are the victim of an analogy that is very inapt. The liver is not a filter. Well, right there, it becomes pretty obvious, and there are no toxins of any kind in your body. So when you say the liver is a filter that filters out toxins, I say it's not a filter and there aren't any toxins. Pshoom! Your whole case is completely gone. So what is the liver and what does it do? The liver is one of the largest organs of the body, and it is basically solidified blood. If you look at a liver, it's blood. It's just blood. And every bit of blood in your body or an animal's body goes through the liver at a fairly rapid rate in a human body. The blood goes through the liver every hour. So there's 24 changes of blood through the liver in a day. Obviously, the liver couldn't filter things. If the liver filtered things, then we'd have to take our liver out now and then and toss it away and get a new one. No, organic processes are not like that at all. The kidneys do have filters, and the liver does send things to the kidneys. And there are things that are too big to get through the kidney filters, but the liver is not a filter. The liver is more like a recycling center. The liver looks at things that are coming through the blood, and it basically has one of two things that it can say about them. It can say, I like you, stay in the blood, or it can say, I don't like you, we're taking you out of the blood. the things that it doesn't like that it takes out of the blood, you could call toxins, but I don't call them toxins. I call them metabolic breakdown byproducts, and without them, you'd be dead. Mm. So you have to have these metabolic breakdown byproducts, but you don't want them in your blood. So the liver removes them from the blood and sends them to the kidneys, but not by filtering, by tagging. The liver actually has a tagging system. Now, there are some things the liver says, I don't want you in the blood, but you're rather complicated, so I'm going to tag you with yet a third tag, and you're going to come back, and these things are called second pass things for the liver. So the liver needs to see them two or sometimes even three times before the liver is prepared to take them out of circulation again. If the liver was a filter, everything would just be filtered through it. In fact, the liver is one of the most regenerative organs in the body. A human being who's a heavy drinker and has cirrhosis of the liver, in which the liver cells are basically being killed. If that person has a teaspoonful of liver left, and we can successfully get them down off the alcohol, and often people die when they withdraw from alcohol, but if we can successfully get them off the alcohol, their entire liver can regenerate from a single teaspoonful of good healthy cells left. And this is because the liver is replaced every single month. Every 30 days we get a brand new liver. Wow! So, far from being a filter, far from dealing with toxins, the liver is blood. The liver is healthy blood, and this is why it's so important for it to be a part of our diet.
Thank you. Why does an alkaline diet work for some and not for others, which means more veggies, grains, and minimal amounts of meat? Can you please provide any insight? Thank you for your time.
I'm not exactly sure what to say. I don't think that what you've characterized as an alkaline diet is an alkaline diet at all. I don't think that an alkaline diet is effective for anyone ever. I think that the blood is maintained at an acid-alkaline balance by the parathyroid. There are two glands called the parathyroid glands. And they basically spend all day long tasting the blood and seeing if it needs to be more acidic or more alkaline. And if they decide that the blood is too acidic, they bring some calcium in. And if they decide that the blood is too alkaline, they bring something else in. So what you eat and what you drink has absolutely no effect whatsoever on your blood, so far as we know, in terms of the acid-alkaline content. Can what you eat have an effect on the acid-alkaline balance of your saliva? It can. But again, there is no scientific evidence of any kind that making the saliva more alkaline is healthier. In fact, there's some fairly good evidence that making it more acidic would be healthier, because that more acidic environment is more lethal to bacteria that can cause tooth decay and periodontal disease. So I don't agree with you that an alkaline diet works for some people, and so I have no way to answer why does it work.
Okay, next question. I have a tendency for candida. My doctor's worried about the fermented foods, as the body ecology diet suggests that one stay away from fermented foods when one has candida. Can you clarify fermented foods and candida?
Yes,
we're hitting all the high topics today.
We are indeed hitting all the high topics. And the topics for which we are basically talking about things that are completely non-accepted. I don't accept any of these things at all. You know, people often talk to me about how much common sense I have. And one of the reasons that I have common sense is because I read. I read over 100 periodicals every month, and many of them are very heavy-duty science because I want to know what's going on in science. Now, Candida itself is an organism found in the healthy human gut. Overgrowth situations I have seen only in two areas. One, someone has done chemotherapy, very heavy-duty chemotherapy for cancer, and they have basically destroyed their gut flora. And all that's left is candida, and then we get thrush in the mouth, and we can tell very clearly that we need to re-nourish the gut flora, and that's when we want more and more and more fermented foods of all kinds. The other situation in which I've actually seen a candida overgrowth is someone dying of AIDS. And it's not infrequent that when someone is terminal with AIDS, that there will be a candida overgrowth, and this is mostly because they are being given very heavy doses of antibiotics, which kill gut flora. And once again, we see thrush in the mouth. Now, if I see somebody with candida overgrowth and thrush, then I'm going to expect that they're going to be dead, and usually very quickly, within a matter of days, if not hours. So, once again, sounding pretty argumentative here tonight, Susan, I don't think you have a candida overgrowth at all. You certainly didn't say that you have thrush, and I doubt that you're a few days away from death. And if you are, well, golly gee, is it AIDS or is it chemotherapy? Is it a strong dose of antibiotics? There's no such thing as a tendency for candida overgrowth. Candida needs to be in the gut, but it needs to be partnered with lots and lots of other things. And those other things are found in fermented foods. The body ecology diet is simply a way for a few people to make a lot of money on other people's misunderstanding and paranoia. I suggest that you eat a healthy diet, forget about this nonsense about having a candida overgrowth, and drink your nourishing herbal infusions. Green blessings.
Thank you. I am concerned with ketosis. I'm so tired when I start the GAPS diet. I'm already tired, and I can't imagine 10 hours of cooking in the kitchen a week, as well as working full-time and continuing my day-to-day activity. Please advise.
I don't know what to advise. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, ketosis, the state of ketosis is achieved when you're eating a high-protein diet, the Atkins diet,
but
so that's what I'm guessing.
Is that what GAPS is?
I'm not really sure, but that's what I'm speculating, is that that she's been advised to reach the state of ketosis to lose weight, and she's concerned because it's making her feel tired and she's already exhausted.
Oh, I didn't realize that she was already on the diet. I thought she was saying that she couldn't imagine cooking for 10 hours a week. And I must say that 10 hours a week is an hour and 15 minutes a day. And that does not sound like long at all to me, to provide nourishment for yourself, which, after all, is the basis of any other work that you wish to do. I must tell you that Atkins himself died of ketosis, and so his diet is not a healthy diet, and I certainly could not recommend that you or anyone else go on that diet. I do recommend that you spend, at least 10 hours a week cooking your food. I think that's a really good idea, and maybe it will help you slow down a little bit and focus on what's important, because cooking your food is a lot more important than just about anything else in your life, and it makes my heart sad that you feel that the other things that you're doing are more important than that. Remember that the important letter between the S and the T is an I, not an A. Fat has never been shown to cause any health problems. Being unfit causes a lot of health problems. So focus on fit and forget the fat. Forget diets. Eat a good, healthy diet. Drink your nourishing herbal infusions and get fit. Forget.
So here's what the GAPS diet is.
Okay.
GAPS diet, Susan. The GAPS diet is starting each day with still mineral or filtered water, a probiotic, room temperature water, and then homemade meat or fish stock, homemade soup with your homemade meat or fish stock, probiotic foods, ginger tea, and adding raw egg yolks on day two, stews and casseroles with meat and vegetables, yogurt, kefir, sauerkraut, fermented vegetables, fermented fish, homemade ghee, ripe avocado, one pancake a day with organic nut butters and squash, eggs scrambled. It all looks, sounds pretty good, just intensive.
That's delicious.
Yeah, it's, I think the problem here is that it's all from scratch. And then on stage four,
well, wait a second. You can buy an avocado. You don't have to grow the avocado.
Yeah.
So,
and then it goes on that you have to press juices and bake bread and cook apples and so on and so forth and so on. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if they're not committed to the diet, they shouldn't do it, probably.
They shouldn't do it, exactly.
Right.
But it bears repeating here. You've probably heard me say it before. When Justine and I lived alone together, Sunday was our day to cook. On Sunday, we made a soup. We baked bread. We cooked a pot of rice. We soaked beans Saturday night, and we cooked them on Sunday. And we cooked a variety of vegetables. When we were done, we had, in fact, actually spent less than 10 hours cooking, and we had all of our own homemade food for the entire rest of the week. If she came home from school and I came home from work and we were too beat, we just ate cold food out of the refrigerator, cold vegetables, cold rice, and cold beans, and we had a good home-cooked meal. If we had a little more energy, we might refry those beans or make some refried rice or do something exciting with the vegetables. But we found that by putting in about 5 hours once a week, that we basically had all of our own home-cooked food. I think that if you made a stock, because I hear there's stocks in there, on your Sunday as well, and then, you know, bought in the things you can, yogurt, avocado, and so on, that you could probably provide a very healthy diet for yourself with about 5 hours of cooking per week. This particular diet seems to me to be rather structured. And the thing that we find with this kinds of diets that are so structured is that people might follow them for a month, 6 weeks, possibly even as long as 3 months, but rarely longer than that. I personally think it's much better to just start today, providing yourself with nourishing herbal infusions and healthy eating habits rather than trying to follow some specific diet.
I bought your book and loved it. Wish I'd only bought that one. After reading, I realized I didn't need all the other books I bought. Thank you. My family is switching over to organic non-GMO eggs, veggies, and fruits, but buying farmer's meat is so expensive. We try to buy organic at the grocery until we can budget for more farm meat. Also, raw dairy is illegal, and none of us can drink enough milk a week to make the cow share price worthwhile. Do you have any recommendations or suggestions on how to make the transition smooth and affordable? I'm asking, what are the most important foods to get from the farm or incorporate in our diets regularly to make up for our commercial meats?
Well, that last sentence was a little bit of a curveball there. You don't make up for commercial meat. Can't make up for it. If you can eat commercial meat, you're eating those chemicals, and those will be in your body for the rest of your life. There's nothing you can do to get them out, and there's nothing you can do to make up for it. So you need to decide whether or not you want those chemicals in your body. In terms of milk share, what I would say is make yogurt, make cheese. Cheese uses up a lot of milk, and then you have whey left over. And we use the whey for cooking our grains. Cheese is really easy to make. Someday, Justine, we should do a little YouTube on making cheese so people will see how incredibly easy it is.
There's yeah, I'd be glad to do that with you.
Yeah. There's a recipe for making yogurt in my menopause book. I suspect that's the book you're talking about. But having written 5 books, when people come up to me like you and say, I'm so glad I got your book, I'm a little at a loss because I don't know which of my 5 books.
And that yogurt recipe is actually at our website, too. If you do a Google search,
oh, good.
How to make yogurt, Susan Weed, it should come right up. Otherwise, if you go to the Bazaar page, SusanWeed.com, Bazaar, I think it's HTM or HTML, and then right in there, there's the yogurt. But you can just Google search it as well.
It's so easy. I mean, it's one of the very first things that we have the apprentices do. When they're really just, you know, raw and they don't know what's going on, we say, here, you're going to make yogurt. Like, the only thing you need for making yogurt is a thermometer. Really, but you must have a thermometer. So that's what I would say. In terms of organic, it's not important to eat fruits and vegetables organic. And people often are amazed when I say this. But let's think about this for a moment. There are basically two varieties of chemicals that are used in food production. Water-soluble chemicals and oil-soluble chemicals. Water-soluble chemicals wash off. They wash off with rain. They're short-term chemicals. They can be problems in the environment because they do wash off, and they tend to then nourish the growth of plants in waterways, and that is a problem for the animals in those waterways because the plants are getting too much nourishment there. The oil-soluble chemicals are more of a problem for us and for everyone down the line because oil-soluble chemicals don't wash off. So if, for instance, a pasture was treated with some kind of oil-soluble chemical, and then a cow ate the plants in that pasture, the cow would ingest that oil-soluble chemical. As I said before, once we have ingested an oil-soluble chemical, there is basically no way for it to leave the body. Well, now, of course, nature hates these kinds of absolutes. So nature says, well, I'll provide a few ways for these oil-soluble chemicals to leave the body. Way number one, ejaculation. Each time a male animal or a male human ejaculates, they excrete some of these oil-soluble chemicals because they're actually part of the sperm. Yes. Each time a woman ovulates, she also releases some of these oil-soluble chemicals because they are actually part of the egg. Now, if you're putting an egg and a sperm together and you're coming up with, oh my goodness, do you mean to tell me that babies are born from eggs that have these oil-soluble chemicals and sperm that have these oil-soluble chemicals? Yes. In fact, we can find these chemicals in the blood of every baby born since the mid-60s, without exception. Furthermore, those chemicals can leave the body through the milk. So if a child is breastfed, then the child is getting the chemicals from the mother's body. This has reached such an extreme in the far north that the Inuit people there, the Inuit women, cannot breastfeed their children because their milk contains such high levels of these oil-soluble chemicals. So it's absolutely unsafe for the women to breastfeed. If all of this makes you want to cry, that is the fourth and last way that these oil-soluble chemicals can be excreted from the human body. Ejaculation, ovulation, lactation, and lacrimation, which is to weep. No, sweating does not get any oil-soluble chemicals out at all. Now, if we go back and think about this, okay, all right, where are we eating ejaculate? Well, we could say that that's somewhat similar to the seeds of plants. And it's true, the seeds of plants do contain oil. So all of the grains, nuts, and beans that we eat would contain these oil-soluble chemicals if they're not organic. So organic nuts, beans, and grains is much more important than organic fruits or vegetables. Eggs, I see. Ovulation, when we ovulate, it is eggs, and therefore, if a chicken has consumed any of these oil-soluble chemicals, they will be, not all of them, but some of them, will be in the egg. So organic eggs then becomes important. And yes, the milk. We said that lactation. So when a cow is eating plants containing oil-soluble chemicals, some of those are going to be in that cow's milk. So organic milk, as well as organic eggs, organic cheese, and organic yogurt definitely trumps organic fruits and vegetables. And then let's think about that. In a gallon of milk, there is going to be some cream. And that cream is the fat part of the milk. Well, those oil-soluble chemicals are in the cream because they're oil-soluble. If we then take that cream and we turn it into butter, we have now concentrated the oil-soluble chemicals. I sat down one day with a list of the chemicals generally used and on what food crops they're used on and whether or not they were an oil-miscible or a water-miscible chemical. And I also had a list of the amount of produce that we consider standard for an American to eat. We're not saying that this is true for any individual, but it's kind of the standard that's used. And at a rough estimate, the amount of oil-soluble chemicals in 1 pound of non-organic butter is roughly equal to the amount of chemicals that you would consume if you ate non-organic fruits and vegetables exclusively for 10 years. So, we can see that getting organic butter, and I know it's expensive. My local supermarket just had a sale on butter, $2 a pound. Now, that organic butter is going to be 3 or 4 or even 5 times that. But remember, that's the single greatest source of problematic chemicals in your diet. There is a wonderful organization, the Environmental Working Group, www.ewg.org. They're the Environmental Working Group. Their website is their initials, ewg.org. And each year they put out the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. So I always post that every year, and I make my buying decisions based on the Clean 15 and the Dirty Dozen. The Clean 15, these are foods that you don't need to buy organically. Asparagus, avocado, cabbage, cantaloupe, sweet corn, eggplant, grapefruit, kiwi, mango, mushroom, onion, papaya, pineapple, sweet pea, sweet potato, watermelon, broccoli, and tomatoes. All right, I know it's more than 15 because I added a couple from 2012 as well. The Dirty Dozen, the foods with the most pesticide residue. Apples, celery, cherry tomatoes, cucumbers, grapes, peppers, nectarines, peaches, potatoes, spinach, strawberries, and sweet bell peppers. Along with the Dirty Dozen, they added two plus foods. And these are foods that did not meet the Dirty Dozen criteria, but were commonly contaminated with pesticides known for their extreme toxicity. And that is kale, collard greens, and summer squash. And
so what's left to eat?
what's left to eat? Well, I said
I'm just
asparagus,
teasing. I mean,
avocado,
that's pretty
cabbage,
comprehensive
cantaloupe,
list.
Sweet corn, right? Lots and lots and lots of stuff, right? So buying from the farmer would be important with your fruit, right? Your apples, your nectarines, your peaches, your strawberries, your grapes. These are on that list. Right? Whereas your more exotic fruits like mango, papaya, and pineapple don't have pesticide residue. What's important to buy from the farmer are things like cherry tomatoes, which spoil very rapidly, cucumbers, right, and peppers. And I know that potatoes are particularly terrible chemicals used with potatoes. I was teaching up in Maine. I went over to the sink, turned on the tap, and stuck my glass under it, and everybody in the room screamed at me, and I'm like, what's the problem? They said, oh, they just sprayed the potato fields, and you cannot drink any of the water for a month.
How awful.
Yeah, like, woo! So I'm a member of a CSA, which is a community-supported agriculture, CSA. And that means that I get local, organic produce on a weekly basis, a lot of it, and I cook it, and I eat it, and I freeze it, and I keep it, and as a matter of fact, I get a share every week, June, July, August, September, and October, and in those months, June, July, August, September, and October, 5 months, in those 5 months, I am able to put away enough food to have my organic produce all winter long as well. Nice.
Yeah. Well, I hope that helps. And I specifically avoided the whole GMO issue because as far as I am concerned, every bite of food that everyone is eating has been genetically modified and has been genetically modified for over 10,000 years. I'm really not concerned about GMO at all.
All right, well, that's a topic for another day. Let's continue with this
day.
Big, long
Actually,
list of questions.
At the very beginning of this, I think we talked about that. So
yes, we did. We started in on that. Okay,
yeah.
Apparently our food, even organic, does not have the same amount of nutrients that they used to before the proliferation of widespread use of herbicides, pesticides, and other chemicals. Can we get all nutrition we need from our foods, or is it necessary to supplement? Thank you.
Supplements don't give you nutrition. Let's just start right there. There is no nutrition of any kind available in supplements. So do you need to be a savvy shopper? You sure do. Can you get the nutrition you need from processed food? Absolutely not. Can you get the nutrition you need from good, wholesome whole foods? Yes. And you know what? I've heard it too. The food we eat doesn't have nutrition. But you know who says it? The supplement manufacturers. In fact, when you look at the science, the truth is that many foods now have more nutrition than they previously did. I mean, we are breeding food for nutrition as well as for the ability to be shipped and so on. But corn, for instance, has far more nutrition. Now, you have to know that yellow corn is going to have more nutrition than white corn. You have to be going for the red tomatoes, not the yellow tomatoes. You have to know that color in food is going to indicate nutrition. But, you know, what I do is I have a lot of stuff on my kitchen walls, and that helps remind me. So I have a lot of things from the Center for Science in the public interest. They have wonderful, wonderful charts. And I love their bullseye. And it's yellow in the middle and it says, consume these as much as you want. And there's all kinds of things in here. And then moderate consumption, it's green, you know. And then very moderate consumption. And then on the very outside is their sparse consumption. I also have a wonderful poster up here. It says, the most important foods for staying healthy and fighting disease. And this includes things like olive oil, citrus fruits, beans, tomatoes, cruciferous vegetables, radishes and horseradish, onions and garlic. So it goes on and on. From an article that I have from 2004 from the U.S. Department of Agriculture Nutrient Database. The data for eggs shows an increase of 66% in riboflavin. It shows an increase of 36% of niacin in wheat. It shows an increase of 6% for calcium in spinach. It shows an increase of 30% for iron in green beans. It shows an increase of 15% in apples for vitamin C, of 48% for vitamin C in peas. It shows an increase of 53% for vitamin A in kale, a 15% increase for vitamin A in green beans. And this is between 1975 and 2004. So I just want you to have some actual facts to go along with that statement that someone told you that our food doesn't contain much nutrition anymore. Now, it is true that there are some losses. I am not saying there aren't. There definitely are some losses, but there are also gains. So, yes, I don't take any supplements of any kind. All of the evidence is that supplements don't make up for an inadequate diet in a country where we have access to lots and lots of food. The place where supplements are useful is places that are impoverished and people are trying to live on one or two bowls of rice a day. There, we see blindness, beriberi, rickets, and a whole host of deficiency diseases, because truly, white rice does not provide enough there. Supplements are useful. For an American, supplements will only injure our health. Blessings.
Thank you. Hello, I'm wondering what percentage of our diets should be raw, if any, and there is a green smoothie revolution going on. Are they essential and necessary for a well-balanced diet?
I'm so sorry that you think there's a green smoothie revolution going on, and I would call it revolting. There is no nutrition of any kind available in raw food. Nothing in the natural world eats raw food, and people die from green smoothies. Please, please, please avoid raw food, avoid raw juices, avoid green smoothies. Drink nice, safe, nourishing herbal infusions made with dried herbs and boiling water, where we kill all the possible pathogens on our food. Green smoothies magnify those pathogens by a factor of 10,000. I am not being extreme or exaggerating when I say that people have died from drinking green smoothies. There are more than a few deaths attributed to drinking green smoothies. Please protect your health. Avoid this revolting revolution.
Yeah. Okay.
And needless to say, you don't need it for your diet, and the amount of raw food that you need in your diet that you need is none, so long as you're eating whole grains. Certainly, if you want to have a salad, and I love salads, make sure you put some olive oil on it, and enjoy.
Thank you. If you were going on a month-long bicycle tour, what simple unprocessed food and preparation equipment would you pack to eat, ferment, nourish, and sustain you on the journey to complement plentiful green and omnivorous foraging along the way? And this person is from New Zealand, by the way.
I was going to say, where do they live here? Where are we talking about?
Things relevant.
Indeed, it does, right? Well, hey, needless to say, I would be taking my dried herbs to make nourishing herbal infusions. I would, you know, be drinking nourishing herbal infusions instead of water at all times. They are my favorite food. Other than that, I don't see if you're going to be doing omnivorous gathering of food, and we hope that that would sometimes include restaurants. I don't see that you need to take anything at all. And if you do, I guess my vote would go to chocolate. Since you won't be able to forage that, huh?
It seems like dried meat would be good too, right?
Well, I thought they were going to go out and hunt.
Are they having fresh meat? Maybe.
I don't know. It says omnivorous foraging.
Yeah, I guess so.
So that sounds like...
Well, what if he can't find any meat? I mean, what if...
Not all hunting trips are successful. That's why I'm hoping that it includes some restaurants, huh?
Oh, no, I don't think they can find anything.
So,
Then they would bring dried meat with them, right?
They could bring dried anything with them.
Dried rice wouldn't be that helpful if you couldn't find water or a way to cook it. But dried meat would sustain you. Do you agree?
I know that they will find water. There's lots and lots and lots of water in New Zealand. That will not be a problem at all.
Okay, so your advice is chocolate and nourishing herbal infusions.
Right, and then anything else that you want, for sure. But my advice would be chocolate. But anything at all is fine.
Yeah, great, okay. Are there any particular foods that are calming for children, boys, 6 and 9 years old?
You know, you're not the only parent who has asked this. And science has been working very hard to try to figure out if there are foods that make kids hyper or if there are foods that calm kids down. And we all know that a turkey sandwich with a glass of milk makes people sleepy. Well, it's not just people, it's kids too. So those are considered very calming foods. As a matter of fact, a cup of hot chocolate is considered to be very calming as well. There are many parents who are firmly convinced that sugar in any form at all, but especially white sugar, really makes their kids absolutely nuts. science has not been able to show that this is true. What science has found is that food coloring makes children hyper. And it's not just red. I've heard people say, oh, you know, it's a red dye that does this. And what science says, it's any dye in food that can really turn on that hyper button in children. So that's what I would say in general and in specific for your boys. Again, I would guess that it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyhow. Processed food contains artificial colors. All processed food contains artificial colors. So what we're talking about here is a diet of whole natural foods and no dyed candy and no dyed fruit snacks and no yogurt with dye in it because it's fruit. And there's a lot of stuff put out for children that has food coloring in it. So you're going to have to become a label reader to avoid food coloring.
All right. I need help as to what part of the linden tree in my yard is good for raw food eating in a salad. I tried using the leaf, as well as the thinner kind of protrusion, a second leaf, and also the tiny antenna-looking things. Are those buds? Is it okay to eat all three parts raw? Do you know what the nutrient content would be?
There is no nutrition of any kind in any raw food. Do not eat linden raw. It's nuts. What? You know, chew your fingernails. You get more nutrition from your fingernails. Give this up. Go look at my raw versus cooked debate. Get a grip. Start cooking your food. Do not ruin your health and your mind by eating raw food. And leave the linden alone. It doesn't want you to touch it. It doesn't want you to eat it raw. No, those are not leaves. Those are samaras. The leaves are kind of heart-shaped, and the samaras, which are part of the flower, are kind of smaller and strap-shaped. None of it is edible raw. I guess what you're calling the antenna are the flower stalks. Perhaps the flowers are gone, and the linden tree has now made berries, and perhaps those berries have dropped. But my simple answer to you is start eating cooked food. Give this up. And the message from linden tree that I'm getting very strongly is to leave her out of it.
What is the best diet for treating an out-of-balance thyroid?
I would refer you to my book, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way. And in that book, you will find everything you need to know about your thyroid and keeping your thyroid healthy. One thing that I can mention, and that is that raw cabbage family plants are quite bad for the thyroid, and that's something that we can all pretty easily avoid. So check out New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, and you will find an entire chapter on thyroid, herbs, and foods that are good for the thyroid and that help with whether the thyroid is hyperactive or hypoactive.
Thank you. Is it necessary to supplement on a daily basis with multivitamins or just during weight loss? I have about 85 pounds to lose. Thanks, guys.
Boy.
Just thought I'd add that one in for you.
Yeah, right. Okay, I'm not a guy. Don't call me a guy. And, you know, in some circumstances, I would not even answer your question because of your rudeness. And I really, really am deeply offended by being called a guy. So don't do it and don't call anybody a guy. Thank you very much. Why do you have to lose 85 pounds? I don't agree that you have to lose 85 pounds. I don't agree that you have to lose any weight at all. Once again, as I've already said tonight, there is no evidence that being overweight leads to any health issues so long as you are fit. So forget losing weight. Get fit instead. Toss out the A between the F and the T and put in an I. Fat doesn't matter, fit does. As a matter of fact, people who are overweight tend to live longer than people who are underweight. People who are overweight survive traumatic illness and accidents far better than people who are at their normal body weight. People who are overweight actually tend to have less health problems than people who are underweight. So I just don't buy it that your weight is a problem. The story on supplements is pretty clear. Looking at studies that included over 8 million people from North America and from Europe, we found that people who took supplements, no matter what they were doing, had no less chronic disease, no less acute disease, and did not live longer than people who took no supplements of any kind ever. That said, that there was no gain, we went on to discover that there were big losses. Those who take ascorbic acid, vitamin C, on a daily basis, double the risk of adult onset diabetes. Those who take vitamin A on a daily basis, double the risk of a hip fracture. Those who take vitamin E on a daily basis, if diagnosed with cancer, are 7 times more likely to die than those who are not taking it. There is no supplement that gives us any real nutrition. There is no reason ever to take any kind of supplement, but why don't you start drinking nourishing herbal infusions? You can find information about nourishing herbal infusions in my books, and you can buy them at wisewomanbookshop.com. You can find information about nourishing herbal infusions at YouTube. My wonderful daughter, Justine, here hosting the show, and my fabulous granddaughter, Monica Jean, and I go all over showing you how to identify, harvest, and prepare plants for your health and well-being. There's lots of things about nourishing herbal infusions there in our little YouTube set. And if you want to know more, I even have a whole course called Drink Your Way to Health with Nourishing Herbal Infusions. Nourishing herbal infusions give you lots of protein, lots of vitamins, lots of minerals, and all for about 4 calories a glass. Oh, my goodness. Not only that, they bring up satiation. When we drink a glass of nourishing herbal infusion before our meal, we eat less at that meal and feel full longer. So forget supplements. They're expensive. They don't work. Instead, start making nourishing herbal infusions, get fit, and I think you're going to really enjoy the improvement in your health and your well-being.
Hmm. I like to soak whole oats and cook them till soft in the water they were soaked in. Any problem with that?
Whole grains, whole seeds, let's put it this way, because whole grains are seeds. Whole seeds contain a variety of substances designed to prevent their being eaten raw. These substances are called scientifically anti-nutritional substances, and they include things such as phytates and phytic acid and other substances as well. What these substances do is they chelate or lock onto needed nutrients in the body and take them out of circulation, so that what you're doing with your oats is basically poisoning yourself and depriving yourself of needed nutrients. If you're going to soak your oats, pour that water out. Then cook the oats in fresh water. It's one of the reasons that people soak grains and soak beans. You may have heard this story before when Sally Fallon came to teach at the Wise Woman Center. I was a little nervous because I know she soaks her grains, and I don't like to soak my grains. I'll deal with some phytic acid and some phytates in my life because I really do not like mushy rice. So when you soak your rice and then cook it, it gets mushy. And I didn't want to you know, hide the fact that I don't soak my grains, and I served her a meal that included rice, that included grain. And she tasted it and said, well, this is just delicious, but I can tell it hasn't been soaked because it's got such a wonderful texture. What did you cook it in? And I said, whey. And she said, oh, you know, that's even better than soaking it, because whey is acidic enough that it actually disables the anti-nutritional substances. So it turned out I was doing something that was approved of by this wonderful person. And how perfect. Whey is not necessarily easy to come by. I have a herd of dairy goats, and I make cheese. So I have gallons of whey. I made a cheese this morning. I have 5 gallons of whey here. We always put aside 1 gallon of it for our own cooking use. And whey is a wonderful, wonderful healing substance. And I hope that this helps you find your way through to better health.
I read that you advocate whole grains for long-term energy. Sally writes about proper preparation of grains before consuming them. So-and-so advocates no grains in the diet, and so-and-so limits grains to such things as amaranth and quinoa because they're technically seeds and not grains. Can this subject be discussed in more detail, please?
Grains are seeds as well. Grains are the seeds of grasses, and they include corn, rice, millet, wheat, rye, and oats. There are a few other grasses, such as teff, that also give us seeds, but those are the primary grains that I just mentioned. Grains are so important in human nutrition that they were, in fact, one of the very first foods that we began to cultivate. We know that our Neolithic ancestors ate lots and lots and lots of wild seeds from a great many plants, including grasses. There are no grass seeds that are inedible, and so our ancestors ate quite a lot of grains. I certainly do include whole grains in my healthy diet, and I believe that whole grains do have a place in everyone's diet. That said, I have nothing against using seeds as grains, because grains are seeds, so to me it's kind of the same thing. The difficulty with amaranth and quinoa is that they are not very translatable into too many foods. You just kind of make them and you eat them, and that is, well, let's face it, a little bit boring. Wheat, on the other hand, can be made into not only bread, but rolls, English muffins, bagels, crackers, pretzels, breadsticks, cookies, cakes, pie dough. Do you see where amaranth and quinoa just aren't cutting the mustard here? I mean, hey, they're great grains, and I certainly eat them, or they're great grain-like seeds, and I certainly eat them. I enjoy them, and I recommend them. At Plant Healer Magazine, which is an online magazine, as a matter of fact, for the past year, I have been going into a lot of detail about a great many grains and grain-like seeds, including wild seeds, which is my favorite, amaranth, a seed from wild amaranth, not from cultivated, lamb's quarter seed rather than quinoa seed, plantain seed, yellow dock seed, and a variety of wild grass seeds are part of my diet as well. So, I'm not exactly sure to what advantage it is to people to be telling people not to eat grains. I do know that there are some people who are sensitive to gluten, and certainly for these people, not eating grains is extremely worthwhile. Because they simply cannot tolerate the grains at all.
Thank you. So I'm going to interject here, if that's okay.
Yeah.
All right?
Please.
There's somebody who has a question, and we have 22 minutes left, and then you have a guest this evening at 9 o'clock. You have the info sheet on that guest?
I do indeed, right here.
Okay. Can you give me the area code that the guest will be calling in from?
I can.
And then I'm going to open the line for this person to ask you a question, and you have 20 minutes to interact with them.
Okay. Kathleen Porter is going to be calling from 503.
503, thank you. All right, so let's see if I can open up the line here. In the 205 area, did you want to speak with Susan this evening?
Yes, I would love to.
Go right ahead. You have 20 minutes to engage.
Okay. Hello, Susan.
Hello.
Wow. Okay. So it's really, thank you. Just want to say that you're amazing and I love you very much. But yeah, I just had a couple of questions because I was reading in your Healing Wise book about like the scientific tradition and how like about the glasses and about like how, you know, scientists want to like fix you and like they want to be like, okay, let's see how quick you can get fixed and healed. So I've been wearing glasses for a very long time, and I don't know, I was kind of like seeing if I could maybe wean myself off of glasses to like strengthen my eyes. So, I mean, I just wanted to see maybe your opinion or like what you think about that at all.
Well, there seem to be me to be a lot of things confused and mixed up here in what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, here's what I say, and perhaps it's not what you understood me to say. 20/20 vision is nothing more and nothing less than how much a 20-year-old can read at 20 feet. That's what 20/20 refers to.
Okay.
So when you are wearing glasses and they are set for 20/20 vision, then that's what that is. It's not perfect vision. It's not your perfect vision. It's simply 20/20 vision.
Oh. Okay.
But I'm not exactly sure where this got all wound up in all that other stuff you were saying. I mean, it's very simple. It's 20/20 vision. Now, I certainly wouldn't want to be on the road with you if you're driving and you can't see.
Yes.
I certainly would not want you to try to read without glasses if you can't see without glasses.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not exactly sure where this thing about getting rid of your glasses is, what the motivation is, or what your goal is, and I certainly do not think that wearing glasses weakens your eyes or that taking them off strengthens your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
That said, there are people who do believe that, and one of their basic exercises is called palming. And it's a very simple exercise. You take your hands and rub them briskly together until the palms warm up. You then place your elbows on your knees while sitting in a chair, lean forward and drop your eyeballs, you're envisioning this, into the palms of your hands. So you're cupping your eyes with your hands so that the cupped palm is over the eye and you relax your eyes so deeply that you feel that your eyeballs are falling out into your palm.
Hmm.
And you do this until your hands no longer feel warm. And then you look, if you can, into the bright sky. Not at the sun, but into the bright sky.
Okay.
We certainly also know that eating brightly colored cooked vegetables, carrots, winter squash, sweet potatoes, cooked tomatoes, is very strengthening and helpful for the eyes.
All right. Wow. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah,
you are welcome. Now, I'm not sure if Justine expected that we were going to be talking for 20 minutes and has now left. land isn't there, but I'm hoping
no,
that
I didn't
still there.
Leave.
Oh,
no,
okay.
I
was a little unclear as to what was happening there, since I think we're pretty much complete. Yes?
I said you have up to 20 minutes. I'm sorry for my lack of clarity.
That's well, thank you for everything.
Our lack of clarity, too.
You're
are
welcome.
So welcome. Okay.
All right.
Good night.
All right.
Okay, we've got another question or two.
Mm-hmm. What is the best diet for treating an out-of-balance thyroid? Did we ask that? Did I ask you that one?
We did, and I suggested that they look in new menopausal years, the wise woman way.
Okay. How to prevent acid reflux?
Dandelion is our savior when we are dealing with acid reflux. Strangely enough, acid reflux occurs because there's not enough acid in the stomach. I know this doesn't seem to make sense, but we think about it. The stomach is not just like a purse with a kind of open bra. It's like a purse with all kinds of compartments in it. And actually, I've never seen a purse kind of like the stomach. But if we did, the purse would have a compartment where things went in. And then when things got soft, they would drop down in the purse into yet another compartment. And then finally, they would drop into a third compartment that had acid. And if there wasn't enough acid in that third compartment, then the things would kind of rotate back up to the first compartment. However, they're now saturated in acid, and this is what causes acid reflux. That acid-saturated food is not supposed to be up in the first part of the stomach, first part of the purse at all. So by taking dandelion in any form, dandelion root tincture, of course, is an easy and lovely way to do it, but in any form at all, then we increase the amount of hydrochloric acid in the stomach and thus decrease acid reflux. I was just reading, and I was absolutely horrified that there were tens of thousands of prescriptions made for acid-inhibiting drugs that were made for children under the age of one last year. That is
painful.
Very, very scary to me, because these drugs are very high-risk drugs. They disturb a lot of things by suppressing the acid production of the stomach. And as you can see from my explanation, they do not actually cure the problem. They simply, it's kind of, you know, like if somebody was clapping and it offended you and you cut off their hands. You know, it's these drugs are not the solution at all. I also, talking to people, find that it is not uncommon for someone to find that their acid reflux goes away when they stop eating refined flour products. I haven't gotten into this, although we've talked about grains and various things. And I, again, to me, this seems to be a pretty simple and straightforward equation. When we are eating a whole foods diet, we are not eating processed foods, and we are not eating enriched foods. Enriched foods contain supplements. Those supplements actually disturb the acid production in the stomach, leading, it appears, to acid indigestion. I have virtually no processed foods of any kind in my diet. I would say the closest that I would come to a processed food would be that, let's see, my sweetheart and I went shopping the other day, and we got some English muffins. All right, so that, and they are 100% whole wheat English muffins made by a fairly local bakery. So, you know, it took a while for me to understand that a lot of the acid indigestion and reflux problems that people are having simply comes from eating refined carbohydrates which have synthetic vitamins added to them.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Do occasional raw foods and cleansing diets have a place in the nourishing traditions way?
Simple answer, absolutely not. There is no such thing as a cleansing diet. There is nothing dirty in you. There is nothing dirty in your body. Remember that your liver is functioning at all times. It never takes a rest. And your liver is removing anything from your blood that should not be in your blood. When you fast, liver efficacy goes down. Within the first 24 hours of a fast, you lose 10% of the functioning of your liver. Within 36 hours into the fast, liver functioning is down by one-third. Now, wait a second. If the liver is what is getting rid of the metabolic byproducts, fasting increases metabolic byproducts. So what that really means is there's no such thing as a cleansing diet. All such diets are actually, what can we call them, dirtifying diets? Diets that increase the amount of metabolites in the blood, diets that decrease the health of the liver. Are you seriously asking me if these things have anything to do with health? Obviously, they have nothing whatsoever to do with health. They are simply mistaken thoughts by people who don't like their bodies.
Is the probiotic effect of plain yogurt affected when I add fruit and granola just before I eat it?
I just had a pastor apprentice here. She apprenticed with me 6 years ago, and she came to visit. All the graduated apprentices get 2 free days and nights here every year. And she's keeping some goats. She actually lives in a fairly large town, but somehow they have found a way to keep some goats there. And she was talking about her trials and tribulations with making yogurt. And I said, well, do you remember what we use to culture our yogurt here? And she said, yes. She said, I do. And I haven't used that. I said, well, I'm going to tell you to go home and get the yogurt that we use as a culture, because it's the only one that I have found that has live cultures in it. And she said, well, I'm going to have to believe you, because I can't get any of the other yogurts that I have bought, and I bought every single one of them, to culture my goat's milk. And I said, well, yes, that's what I was told too. I was told that you cannot culture raw goat's milk. First of all, you have to pasteurize it. And even at that, you had to add powdered milk in order to make thick yogurt. But I find with using the only commercial yogurt that actually contains real, live and active cultures, and lots of them, that I can culture my goat's milk, my raw goat's milk, and very, very well indeed. As a further adjunct to this, one of the students at a weekend class said, you know, I'd heard you talking about that really good yogurt and how it's the only one with cultures in it. And she said, you know, I work in a lab and I work with a microscope. And one day, just out of curiosity, it was kind of a slow day in the lab, I had some yogurt and I put it on a slide and looked at it under the microscope. And even though it was an organic and expensive yogurt that claimed to have live and active cultures, I have to tell you, from looking at it in a microscope, it didn't. She said, so I got curious, and I went out at my lunch break, and I got one of every yogurt I could buy. And that's a lot, because I work in Manhattan. She said, including the one that you favor. She said, and I labeled the containers A, B, C, D, E, and so on. And then I labeled the slides, and I put some yogurt from each one on a slide, and I'm looking under the microscope, and it's looking like the surface of Mars. Mars, Mars, oops, Mardi Gras. There it is, live active cultures, having a party, and sure enough, it was the yogurt that you said has live active cultures, the first yogurt maker, and the best. And that's Dan.
Yeah.
You want to put some fruit in it, you want to put some granola in it, I don't see that it would have any problem at all. But do make it Danon if you're really looking for live active cultures.
Thank you.
And if you don't want to just eat the Danon yogurt, use it as a culture to culture your own milk of a superior quality.
I use one cup
of plain Danon to culture a gallon of goat's milk. I don't know if you remember, but one time Michael went out and bought the yogurt, and he didn't read the label, and he got vanilla. And he used it as a culture, and all of our yogurt tasted like vanilla.
I do remember that for quite a while.
Remember that, yeah.
So let's see. Looks like we may have time for one or two more questions. If you are on an antibiotic protocol for Lyme disease, what herbs would be good for infusions?
The herb that I trust the most while people are taking antibiotics and dealing with Lyme is astragalus. Astragalus is a very safe, very nutritive herb and can interface very easily with antibiotics. I do believe that the medical opinion nowadays is that you should eat some yogurt while you're taking these antibiotics as well. And do be aware that there are usually co-infections with the Lyme, and that frequently taking antibiotics to get rid of the Lyme can actually make those co-infections worse. Do you have anything to say about that, Justine?
Not really sure. I'm deficient
not
in
really.
B12, and I'm not really thinking very well right now. It's
that's
late,
fine.
And I'd like to be in bed asleep. So
I hear you.
That's my answer to you. Is I'm just hanging on by one fingernail.
One thread.
I know.
Okay.
I look well from the outside, but I'm really not feeling very well on the inside.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see. I think we have maybe one more question. And then after we do that question, I can go ahead and introduce our guest.
Great.
And then she'll be on.
Best diet for osteoporosis and remineralizing teeth. My enamel wore off when I drank warm lemon water religiously every morning for years. Teeth got really thin. Could not tolerate milk or milk products.
Well, that's interesting because you were just talking about somebody had told you to drink lemon water every morning. And here's the person on the other side of it saying, eek, it took the enamel off my teeth. Nourishing herbal.
Well, you
infusion.
Just put that out of context. That was somebody who told me that 10 years ago, and in the same sentence I told you that I tried it for one day and I didn't like it. It made
you
me
didn't
sick.
Like it,
and
right,
I,
exactly.
So if you're going to relay, you know, conversations that we had, I wish you would at least relay the entire sentence instead of just cherry-picking the part that you want to share.
I didn't say that you did anything. I just said that somebody had suggested it. That's all I said. I didn't say you did it or didn't do it. I simply said someone had suggested it. And here's somebody on the far side of it saying that it created a problem for her. And this is pretty much what we've been saying all evening, is that these diets that have these special things that you're supposed to do generally do not improve health. What I'm suggesting is a good whole foods diet and drinking up to a quart of nourishing herbal infusion on a daily basis. That, for me, is the best diet for everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Using raw milk formula for my 3-month-old baby, he spits up a lot, pukes. I think it might be yeast. What could I put to substitute so he gets enough B vitamins? Is molasses okay?
Molasses, so far as I know, is not a source of B vitamins. Many babies spit up. It's part of being a baby. Baby's digestive system is not really fully developed. It takes a good many months for the baby's digestive system to actually develop after birth. So, periodical I was reading was from www.worstpills.org, and it's from Public Citizen, Worst Pills, Best Pills News. Medicalizing normality. The use of proton pump inhibitors to treat acid reflux in symptoms in infants is at an all-time high. By 2009, a total of 500,000 prescriptions were dispensed to 145,000 U.S. infants, according to a recent analysis. This is despite the fact that until 2011, no drug of this type was approved by the FDA for use in children younger than 1 year old. And they go on to say that throwing up, acid indigestion, is absolutely absolutely normal in children. We are medicalizing normality. Noted pediatrician Dr. Eric Hassel said, encapsulating the phenomena underlying the overdiagnosis of infant digestive problems. In most infants, these symptoms are life, not a problem. Right? So it's not a disease. It doesn't warrant treatment. And too many doctors are resorting to unnecessary and risky fixes for children that have something very normal going on. Breastfeeding mothers can try reducing their intake of milk or eggs, as some babies can react to these. Do not discontinue breastfeeding in favor of formula unless the baby is throwing up after every feeding. If you are breastfeeding and you opt for formula, thicken the formula with rice cereal. Avoid large volume feeding. Try smaller and more frequent feedings. And while laying infants on their stomachs rather than their backs was previously recommended, this is no longer recommended, as the baby could then throw up and actually choke on the vomitus. After feeding, place the infant, if at all possible, in a fully upright position, or if sleeping, on their back. Welcome! Kathleen Porter is the author of Natural Posture for Pain-Free Living, The Practice of Mindful Alignment, and the author of Sad Dog, Happy Dog, How Poor Posture Affects Your Child's Health and What You Can Do About It. Kathleen Porter has traveled the world researching natural human alignment and has taught the principles of this through the University of Hawaii at Hilo, the Natural College of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon, and the Ethio Make It Institute in Rhinebeck, New York. I am so glad that you're with us tonight, Kathleen.
Well, thank you, Susan. I'm just delighted to be joining you.
So, what are you talking about? You're talking about natural alignment. Could you help us understand what that is?
Sure, yes. I'm actually talking about natural skeletal alignment, which is the alignment that is, it turns out, is innate to the human design. This is what all healthy toddlers discover on their own when teaching themselves how to sit up, how to stand and walk. If we think of it in these terms, everything in our world is governed by basic natural laws of physics. That determine such things as the forces of gravity and the vertical axis through which these forces are distributed. And as human beings, we are a part of this world, and we are therefore governed by these same laws. So it's only recently that we've really begun to understand that when you examine the skeletal alignment of a toddler standing, and I compare it to the alignment of a small woman in a number of places in the world where women still carry very heavy loads of rocks and water and things like that on their heads, and the ones who do it successfully without, you know, any kind of strain, but just do it with great ease. And you compare this with the skeletal alignment of people who age into their 70s, 80s, and beyond, with elongated spines and effortless flexibility and enduring vitality, then you see that they all maintain this same skeletal alignment. So that's what we're talking about.
I'm not getting it.
You're not. Okay. Well, here's
I still don't know what alignment is. I know that toddlers have it. I know that small women have it. I know that old people have it. But I see a lot of old people who don't have it.
Right. You certainly do.
Who seem to be all crumpled up. So you mean standing straight, like there's
yes.
a ruler against your back? Is that what we mean by alignment?
No. And this is effortless. So here, let's break it down to a structure like a house, for instance.
So aren't we already aligned if we were aligned as toddlers?
Well, we lose it.
We lose it. How do we lose it?
We lose it. Well, we lose it for a lot of reasons, but in our part of the world, we are losing it at younger and younger ages. So when you take a child and put that child in a car seat, and then from the car seat they go to into a stroller, and then they are put into a bouncy seat and some sort of swing, and often spend tremendous amount of time in these contraptions and devices that tuck the tailbone under, that collapse the front of the body. And then we, you know, have a modern lifestyle where we sit for hours on cushy couches and slump in front of computers and watching TV and this kind of thing. And it's all about the position of the pelvis. The pelvis is like a foundation block in the construction of a house. And so if you were to think of a cement block that you might use to build a carport or something and put a post on, and you were to have that cement block and it were not at the right angle, the post that sits on it, which is an oversimplification for the spine, would be thrown off of this this line. And so then muscles would have to overcompensate to hold this structure up and this
so
body
are we talking about the spine then?
Well, yes, we're really
I'm kind of lost because I don't know what
okay,
the building block
right. Well,
is
it
my
way.
Foot
this,
is it my elbow, is it my neck?
No, well it's the torso, it's your when you're sitting.
Is it just my pelvis?
No, it's everything. Your pelvis, when you're sitting, let's just start with sitting first.
Okay.
When you're sitting and you're sitting on a pelvis, you can, when I teach this to children in the second and fourth grades, they are very easily embarrassed, so you can't really say too much about pelvises, and God forbid you use the word pubic, they just can't stop laughing, they get so embarrassed. But one way that children can really understand this concept is if they, and this is from the title of the book that you mentioned, if you think of a sad dog and you ask a child, what does a sad dog do when it is, you know, getting scolded for chewing a slipper or something like that, it tucks its tail between its legs. And so any one of us doing that, if we were to tuck our tails between our legs, we would notice that if you're sitting now, you could do this along with me, you might notice that your back rounds as you tip your pelvis backwards like this. So putting babies into strollers and car seats and this kind of thing begins to set the stage quite literally for the collapse of the spine. Now, remember, the spine is the trunk of the tree. The spine is also the heart of the central nervous system, because the spinal cord runs through the spine, and so all these messages being relayed back and forth. So this, you know, is much bigger than just talking about, you know, a backache or a neckache or a sore hip or something like that. It also affects a whole lot about the way the body functions and the various systems of the body and the messages that they're getting, etc. Is this starting to make more sense at all?
Well, let me see. You're saying that as toddlers, we have natural alignment of the pelvis and the spine.
Right. And so nobody... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But that we are put into postures that change this. Now, I'm having a hard time following you because I put my granddaughter into a car seat a great many times, and that car seat holds her in a very upright and very pelvic-friendly posture. There's no slumping of any kind available.
Well, that's great.
And I have friends with car seats. I put lots of kids in car seats, and I do not see any car seat of any kind that allows any kind of slumped posture.
Oh, well.
So I'm not really sure. And are you really suggesting that we should never put our children in a car seat? I mean, it's very dangerous.
No, I'm not at all, because obviously
okay, well, I'm a little alarmed at that, you know. I certainly, you know, I will tell you that I personally never put my daughter in a stroller. I held her, and I carried her, and I did not find that any of that felt good to me. But I know a great many people who put their children in a wide variety of slings and baby carriers and so on, none of which provide any support for the back. Are you saying that those are not a good idea either?
Well, what I'm saying is that if you, it's so hard to talk about this without the photographs, and I would like to just mention that on my website, which is naturalposturesolutions.com, I have a number of photographs of babies in these positions, and it, and I also
these,
I don't know
these positions, these positions being the slumped positions.
Yeah, well, slumped and
or
then
being the natural positions. I'm a little unclear.
Both.
Okay, so you have photographs of both. All right, good.
Yes, and it's really much easier to see the difference. You know, if you look at the ways children, and you mentioned your children and my children the same, I wore my children a lot. I, you know, carried them around. They didn't spend a whole lot of time in devices. I do just want to mention that I'm not for a moment suggesting we shouldn't be using car seats. I'm just saying that we are living in a culture at a time when there is sort of an over-reliance on some of these contraptions. And if a child is going to spend a bit of time in a car seat, it's a good idea for that child not to then also spend a lot of time in these other sitting devices. So
I understand, and I actually had a teacher who would not teach us if we were sitting in chairs.
Mm-hmm.
We had to sit on the floor because she said sitting in a chair basically collapses your pelvic floor.
Well, it does if you don't know how to sit in a chair. It would have been really helpful if your teacher had known how to guide you how to sit in a chair properly. Then, you know,
well,
that...
What he said was that your entire body realizes that if the chair were to disappear, you would fall. And so you're in tension, and there's no way to learn when you're in that much tension, even if you're unaware of it. So, I mean, I personally, when I sit in a chair, I always choose a chair that I can pull my legs up and sit cross-legged. Because that then engages my pelvic floor. It causes my spine to be upright. It's very difficult to get my spine upright when my legs are bent in an L shape, is what I find.
Right, right. Well, I'm personally, I'm like you, I'm much more comfortable in a cross-legged position. But there are a lot of people who don't have the flexibility in their hips at this time in their lives in order to be able to do that. And so it's helpful for them to be able to know how to sort of park the pelvis in the position that allows for that nice upright spine. I think so
and
many
is
people...
is that in your book?
Yes,
the Natural Posture
yes.
for Pain-Free Living?
Yes, yes. There's just
good.
A lot of information and lots of photographs and illustrations that
there
tell
are lots
the story.
And lots of wonderful... Wonderful. I mean, I do have the book, and the photographs are fabulous, and they're tremendously helpful. But since we're doing this, you know, for people listening, I was hoping that we could explain it to them. But I do just want to reiterate what Kathleen is saying, is that the book, Natural Posture for Pain-Free Living, makes this abundantly clear. There is no page in this book that is not illustrated. Every single page is illustrated, and most pages have 2 to 8 illustrations on them. The illustrations are superbly chosen. They really make it very, very clear what Kathleen is talking about in terms of the difference between sitting with your spine in a 90-degree angle to the floor or sitting with your spine in a 50-degree angle to the floor, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are even instructions for how you can lean back in a chair and how to bend and all of these things by maintaining, and this is the key, the bones are designed to move, well, to align in a particular relationship to each other. And toddlers because nobody teaches them. You know, we don't really teach our children how to roll over or how to sit up or how to crawl. It's an inside job. You know, they really focus a lot of their attention. They're very, very concentrated as they're sorting this out. And when it comes to standing, finally, they have to really figure out, okay, now, how do I do this with this and balance this giant, heavy bowling ball like head on top of a stick, the spine, and do this without falling over. And so that's a big motivator for them to figure it out. And so they make these discoveries. They don't understand anything about the vertical axis of gravity or, you know, any of those kinds of details about how to align the skeleton. They just do it through a process of trial and error. But once they have figured it out, they have, in fact, aligned themselves in this very precise way that our species is designed to inhabit our bodies. And so the exciting thing about this is that for those of us who have struggled with a lot of discomfort and pain and tension in the past, learning these principles and putting them into practice is what we learn from the toddlers and from the women who carry the heavy things on their heads, is how to realign our own skeletons so that we can find, you know, a lot of relief from a lot of the tension and pain that, you know, plagues so many people. So,
yes,
that's what we're talking about.
And your book is not just, in case, listener, in case you're thinking, oh, well, this is just, you know, for people who have, like, muscular skeletal problems or, like you said, headaches. Your book covers a lot of things. It covers how this alignment maintains a good flow of the blood to the brain and help keep us thinking well. It talks about how alignment affects the nervous system and anxiety and depression. It talks about how alignment affects the digestive system and acid reflux. It talks about a huge variety of things that you wouldn't maybe necessarily right at the beginning start to think about in terms of alignment, especially if you're kind of thinking it just means posture. But really this is far beyond because when we do teach children, we kind of teach them, you know, stand up straight, have a good posture.
Right. And we have misunderstood.
Which I don't think is what you're talking about, right?
No, not at all. I'm talking about
natural
posture as opposed to a sort of cultural adaptation to what we think is good posture, which requires effort and struggle. So it's no wonder that posture is a dirty word in many people's minds, because it reminds them of that struggle and effort, and it also reminds them of their mothers nagging them. So it's, you know, when we understand what our natural posture is effortless, it's comfortable, it's easy, and the secret to it is that it relies on aligned bones. So we live in a culture that's all about muscles. We're muscle-obsessed. You know, we go to the gym and we strengthen them. We go to exercise classes and we stretch them. But, you know, there are a lot of people in the world who have never lost this alignment, and they've never heard of a gym. They've never heard of yoga and stretching, and they somehow manage to be flexible and strong in a balanced kind of way. So it's helpful to remember that the bones and the muscles work together in the musculoskeletal system, and that you can't just focus on the muscles without including the role of the bones. And the really important role of the bones is to be the framework. Think of a building, a house that's being built. You're driving down the street, you come by this house that's being built, the walls haven't gone on yet, but they've framed the whole house and put on the roof. The carpenters have taken a tremendous amount of care to line up all the posts and wall studs along this plumb line, this vertical axis of gravity. And even though the human skeleton has bones that are very odd-shaped and it can be confusing and difficult to recognize it for what it is, when you really examine the skeleton from the perspective that we're talking about right now, you see that the weight of the roof or the weight of the head is distributed through this center line. And when we arrange our skeleton around that center line, then the bones hold us up and we don't have to struggle and the muscles can be much more relaxed. So I hope that I'm making this clear.
Yes, you are. Again, you know, the pictures, of course, the pictures are so much better
than any words could ever be. There was a set
of pictures, I will admit, that I found extremely interesting. And they are the pictures of you at three different ages. And you have you as the sad dog. Then you have you as the tense dog. And then finally you have you as the happy dog.
Right, right. And, these pictures weren't posed. They were taken at these specific periods in my life. So the sad dog, even though I wasn't personally so sad, it was actually a wonderful time in my life. I was a young mother and just loving it. But by posture, I had very collapsed posture, and that particular photograph was taken in my early 30s. And but I did have a lot of pain. You know, I would throw out my back, sometimes just nursing a baby, you know. And
So let me see if I can explain to the listeners. In this picture, what you see is a lively and very beautiful woman whose shoulders are pulled forward. The whole collarbone is crunched because of the forward pull of the shoulders. Her arms are kind of clutched in front of her body. And this forward pull of the shoulders then is kind of pushing her upper back out. And to kind
of compensate. Can you see how my shoulders are tucked?
Upper back being thrown out, the lower back is thrown in. And so, yes, there is a curve, there is a double curve in the spine, but in a way this has super accented that.
Right, right.
And you know, most people unaware of alignment would not say that you have bad posture in this photograph. There's nothing that we would...
Go ahead.
The breathing and the nervous system is going to be impacted by the forward curve of the spine and the throwing of the shoulders forward.
Right.
In the second photograph, you look like you are in the yoga army.
Yes, I am. By that time, I was a yoga teacher.
And now the shoulders are thrown as far back as they were thrown front before. So the head and the neck have to come into a forward tension to compensate for this, and now the pelvis must jut out extremely in the back to also compensate for that. The knees are now rigid and locked in every way. The sad dog posture looks happier than the tense dog here,
right.
Which is
but
so,
both of them are
so
opposite
stiff and judgmental.
Oh,
and you actually talk about how you found yourself more judgmental, and you can see this in your posture. And then we come to our author, Kathleen, now in her 60s, in a happy dog stance. And lo and behold, although we still have some natural curve at the shoulders, some natural curve in the lower back, we do not have an exaggerated curve. The shoulders are now actually at the midline of the body, so that the arm drops naturally down with the wrist coming to rest right about where the hip is. The only thing that I would say about this last happy dog thing is that your toes are pointed, for me, way too far out to the sides. Now, maybe you were in the midst of doing something, But
I probably was, yeah.
I wouldn't want to see somebody standing like that. As a matter of fact, it's one of the first things I do when the apprentices come. One of the first things we do is that we stand and sing a song, and I look around at how they are standing and get started to work on their posture on the first day they're here, Kathleen.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't even think that they are capable of receiving any training until they are in a natural alignment.
So I would just like to point out that as you look at those three pictures, if you were to think of that plumb line, that center line, you would see that in the sad dog, the first one, when I was in my early 30s, I'm sort of on the back of that line. And then in the next one, when I had become a yoga teacher and thought that I had really improved myself tremendously, I had now lifted myself up in front of the line. I had pushed myself in front of that line. And then in the final picture, I'm now lined up along the line. Can you see that?
Yes, absolutely. Even though the lines are not drawn there, we can imagine...
Yeah.
Those lines, and that's kind of what I was saying. The shoulder is right over the hip, which is right over the ankle. Whereas in the yoga posture, the ankle is way back of the hip, and the shoulder is back of the hip. And in the sad dog, both the shoulder is forward. The legs are very well done in the sad dog, though. The knees are not hyperextended. There's a very nice line between the hip and the ankle. That the yoga that the yoga has changed into a very stiff stance.
Right, there's a lot of rigidity.
Yeah, so wherever we are, there is something that we can do to help ourselves. And there's a beautiful photographic essay on sitting and standing. And our Tai Chi teacher goes through a long class on how to sit. And at the end of it, I say, you know, you don't really need to teach women that. And he says, what? And I said, yeah, all you have to do is to tell a woman, approach every chair as though it were a public toilet. And they know exactly what to do. Rather than just plopping and collapsing their legs, they maintain the energy and the musculature in their legs. They put their seat back. They fold their body forward. And they hover. And I say, now you can actually sit.
Right. That's a very interesting point.
Most women already know this move.
That's true. That's very funny and very apropos.
Yes. So of all of the things that you write about and teach about and know, what would you like to say for the last minute of our show?
Well, I would just like to encourage people to, if, especially anyone who is struggling with discomfort in their body and other health issues that they think might be helped by this, to find out more. They can go to my website at naturalposturesolutionsplural.com and look at some of the pictures there. And if they're interested, they can order the book from there. I even have some little posture aid products that can be useful in getting people started. But most of all, I would just like people to know that it is easy and comfortable and sort of the way back home to who we really are as embodied presence to develop this sense of how to inhabit our bodies in this aligned and comfortable way.
Catherine Porter, thank you so much for gifting us all with your book, Natural Posture for Pain. Living. It is a beautifully, beautifully done book, and thank you so much for being with me here at Women's Radio. Green blessings, everyone. Thank you for helping me reweave the healing cloak of the ancients. Till we meet